You're listening to Clinical Conversations. We're back after a summer hiatus for a new round of talks with people shaping the future of clinical medicine. I'm Joe Elia. This week we talk about a question that our guest poses in the title of a recent essay, May Doctors Help You Die? Dr. Marcia Angel is a sponsor of a ballot initiative here in Massachusetts, Question 2, the so-called Death with Dignity Initiative. She is a senior lecturer in social medicine at the Harvard Medical School and was a colleague of mine when she served as editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine. Welcome, Dr. Angel.
Thank you, Joe. It's great to be here.
I like to start with the language of the ballot question, and so let me quote. A yes vote would enact the proposed law allowing a physician licensed in Massachusetts to prescribe medication at the request of a terminally ill patient meeting certain conditions to end that person's life. A no vote would make no change in existing laws, end quote. So, Dr. Angel, your name appears as the first petitioner on the proposal, so please tell us why you think it's important.
Yes, I'd be happy to, although I think I would reverse your question and say why not. Mm-hmm. What this does is to give patients who are suffering unbearably from a terminal illness, an illness that at least two doctors believe will cause their death within 6 months, it gives these patients the right to ask their doctor to write a prescription for a medication that they can have to bring about a somewhat faster death and a much more peaceful death if and only if they choose. So it gives them the right, essentially, people who are dying, the right to end their lives a little bit sooner and more peacefully. I can't see any reason to oppose such a compassionate law and a law that utterly respects the rights of patients to have control over their own deaths.
Well, the polls do show a generally favorable reaction to the proposal. It's the polls that I've seen are all over 50% in favor.
Yeah, 64% the last poll.
But you mentioned that you couldn't imagine why people would be opposed to it, but there is opposition, and you've encountered them in public forums, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. What have been their arguments briefly, and how have you answered those arguments?
Proponents of the Death with Dignity initiative favor the term physician-assisted dying over the older term physician-assisted suicide.
Okay.
Because it distinguishes this from the typical suicide in which someone with a normal life expectancy chooses death over life.
Mm-hmm.
And here, unfortunately, these terminally ill people don't have that choice. They are going to die imminently within a matter of months. So they're not choosing death over life. They would love to be able to live. Mm-hmm. They're simply choosing the manner of an inevitable death.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there are essentially three organizations that oppose the Death with Dignity Act. And these are the organizations, not necessarily the membership of the organizations. The first is the Catholic Church, which opposes it as a matter of religious doctrine, which they have a perfect right to do. And as we know from the issue of birth control, a lot of Catholics, at least Catholic women, do not follow the teachings of the church hierarchy. And I suspect that will be the case here, too. People of whatever religion, almost everyone knows somebody who has died a protracted, difficult death and has wanted to die sooner. So I think ordinary members of the Catholic Church will probably break with their hierarchy on this. I hope they do. The second group is the Massachusetts Medical Society, like the AMA, opposes physician-assisted dying because they say it's, quote, inconsistent with the physician's role as healer, close quote. I find this unpersuasive, to say the least. Mm-hmm. It's a very limited and rigid definition of what doctors should be doing. In these cases, by definition, healing is no longer possible. Simply isn't possible. They have an incurable illness that will inevitably cause their death within a short time. So since healing is impossible, then what should a doctor be doing? And in my view, the doctor should be responding more flexibly to the specific circumstances of each patient. And if healing is not possible, then their, it seems to me, primary role should be to relieve suffering and to do so in accord with the patient's wishes. Mm-hmm. And that's what this law permits. The third group is a group called Second Thoughts, and it's a disability group. And what this group says is that this invites people to evaluate the quality of a life. And we have what some people would think is a poor quality of life. And so we feel threatened by question two. Mm-hmm. And what I try to say to the people who believe this is that this isn't about you. You would not qualify for a physician-assisted dying. This law is about terminally ill people, not about disabled people. Even if you decided that your life wasn't worth living and you went to a doctor and said, I want assisted dying, the doctor would say, you can't have it. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't qualify because you're not terminally ill. So in some sense, I think that they're creating a straw man. They're suggesting that they're vulnerable when they're really not vulnerable. What this law says is what they believe, in a sense. The quality of life is a judgment that should be made by the person living that life. Mm-hmm. And if they want to live, they should, by all means, have every help in doing so. But if they don't, if they're dying by inches, then let them do what they want.
I've read the proposal, and it's full of protections for all the parties, including hospitals that may want to prohibit use of its provisions in their facilities.
Yes.
Do you believe you've got airtight protections in case, by and large, in place?
Oh, more than airtight.
Yeah.
And I think the best way to evaluate that is to go to the State of Oregon's website. It's the Division of Public Health mm-hmm. of the State of Oregon, and they have detailed data on how the law has been used there. The Massachusetts Death with Dignity Act is identical to the law that has been in effect in Oregon for nearly 15 years. And the Division of Public Health there, every year, puts out data on how and why the law is used and how often the law is used. And it does so year by year, and it also does so cumulatively. Mm-hmm. So if you go there now, you'll find 14 full years of experience.
Yeah.
And what you find is that this law, in a nutshell, has been used exactly as intended. There are no documented instances of abuse of any sort. The safeguards are honored. The law has been used sparingly. In the last year, it accounted for only 1 in 500 deaths, or 0.2%. Mm-hmm. Most people find palliative care sufficient. The palliative care in Oregon, incidentally, is among the best in the country. Most people there find that sufficient. But for those who don't, who for one reason or another, are still suffering unbearably, this gives them an option. And incidentally, it's an option for doctors, too. Mm-hmm. No doctor in Oregon or Washington or Montana, other states where it's legal, and in the Massachusetts law, no doctor will be required to participate. They can refuse for any reason whatsoever.
You've mentioned these things in your essay in the New York Review of Books on mm-hmm. October 11th. I'll put a link to that essay.
Good.
Here and also to the Oregon website, which you also mentioned. There, as I was thinking about this, Dr. Angel, the one thing came to mind is what about family opposition? Could patients find themselves in court trying to appeal against injunctions or whatever? I couldn't imagine a worse way to. Well, yes, I could imagine worse ways, but it would be pretty uncomfortable for the person whose interest is in dying.
Well, by definition, the law is restricted to patients who not only are terminally ill, but who are adults capable of making their own decision.
Mm-hmm.
So it can't be used by people who have impaired decision-making capacity, for example, who have Alzheimer's, can't be used by advanced directives. The patient must be capable of making that decision at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And in addition, the patient has to make two oral requests at least 2 weeks apart, and one written request with two witnesses, one of whom cannot be related to the patient or cannot benefit in any way from the patient's death. So there are a lot of safeguards to make sure that it's entirely voluntary. And one of them is the necessity that the patient is able to swallow a full glass of liquid.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have impairment of your capacity to swallow, you would be ineligible to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So it is heavily protected against any sort of involuntary element. And in addition, I should point out that euthanasia is absolutely prohibited.
Mm-hmm.
in all states and in the Massachusetts Act. Euthanasia defined as someone else injecting a lethal substance. That can't happen. The patient must himself or herself swallow the medication.
So it's going to be self-administered then.
There is no requirement that the patient notify the family, if assuming he has a family.
There is a suggestion that they do so, though.
Excuse me?
There is a suggestion that they do so.
There is
a
suggestion, a recommendation that they do so.
Right. Okay.
But if a patient wanted to oppose, a family wanted to oppose that, and that has not happened that I know of in Oregon, but if such a thing were to happen, the family would really have no standing.
Mm-hmm.
Because the patient is a competent adult.
Okay. There is a provision in the Act for a patient to find another physician.
Yes.
They need to find two physicians, actually, don't they?
Mm-hmm. Yes, they do.
And do you think that option would be, from your experience with the people in Oregon and with the Oregon bill, has that option been widely exercised, or are most physicians willing to participate? Do you have any numbers on that?
That's a hard question to answer, because the only real study of physicians who refuse or who agree is a fairly old one. I think it goes back, it was published in the New England Journal, I think in 2000, by Linda Ganzini's group at the Oregon Health Sciences University. And at that time, about 80% of physicians refused, which, as I said, they can do for any reason whatsoever.
Uh-huh.
I suspect that it wouldn't be that high now, because at that time, the federal government was asserting that this was a violation of the Federal Controlled Substances Act, and that doctors were in jeopardy of losing their license if they participated in this law. That is no longer the case. The U.S. Supreme Court in 2006 finally said that the Oregon law could not be interfered with on that basis.
Hmm.
So doctors no longer have to worry if they agree to participate in the law. One study found, also by Linda Ganzini's group, found a slight majority of doctors who were willing to participate in the law. That doesn't say whether they all had or not. I think
right.
It was something like 51%.
I see.
In Oregon, the public overwhelmingly favors this law. The last poll I saw a few years ago was 77%.
Mm.
And I suspect by now the percentage of doctors who favor it has gone up too.
You know, there is a lot that the physician needs to do to enable the patient to come to this decision and to protect the patient and to make sure that the patient's of sound mind and
mm-hmm.
will be otherwise dead within 6 months. What sort of, this is an indelicate question, but let's mm-hmm. raise it, what kind of reimbursement for that sort of service do you envision?
Mm-hmm.
And because this is definitely more than happens in a routine visit.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think just as in primary care where there's no procedure done, where the doctor simply writes a prescription, that a doctor would be reimbursed for his or her time.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know what the reimbursement level is in Oregon.
Okay, it's probably not much more than for a routine visit, though.
I mean, this would take more time.
Right.
And I think physicians should be reimbursed accordingly.
Yeah. I'm just wondering whether a sub-subspecialty will arise that of willing physicians who would... I can't imagine anyone could make a living doing this, and I'm just raising the question because I'm just being practical about it.
Yeah, you know, Joe, I have not thought about that. I'm not sure I would be very comfortable with a new specialty arising anyway.
That's true. Okay, and you have an interesting, I don't know whether to call it a philosophical argument in your essay, about the patient's right to refuse treatment currently. But on the other side of that, if there's no treatment to offer, can you rehearse that argument for me?
Yeah, I think it's very important to understand this as a historical movement and to understand how handling death has changed over the years. For millennia, when people became terminally ill, they died fairly promptly, very often of pneumonia. But after antibiotics came into widespread use, that didn't happen as much, not nearly as much. Then we had other technologies like dialysis and mechanical ventilators that could keep people alive long after they wanted to be kept alive. I mean, some people use the expression they're flogged in the ICU. They're forced to live whether they want to or not.
Yeah.
And over a period of about 14 years, from the 1976 case of Karen Ann Quinlan, which was the first such case, we came to a consensus in this country that patients had a right, or their proxies, to refuse, withdraw life-sustaining treatment if they wanted to, for any reason. So if a patient finds life no longer worth living and has kidney failure and requires dialysis, that patient can say, I've had enough with the dialysis. Let me alone. I want no more treatment. And that happens with dialysis patients quite frequently. And in ICUs every day, in hospitals all over the country, for one reason or another, it's decided to remove a patient from life-sustaining treatment, often a ventilator, sometimes in hospices, artificial feeding. So we agree on that. It wasn't immediate. It took 14 years before that was commonly agreed upon. In 1990, this was 14 years after the Quinlan case, the U.S. Congress passed something called the Patient Self-Determination Act. And that states that any patient who is admitted to a hospital that receives federal funding, and that's nearly all of them, has a right to refuse any treatment for any reason whatsoever, even if it's life-sustaining treatment, and to name a proxy to act for them if they become incapable of acting for themselves. So that became the law of the land in 1990, and that was affirmed by the U.S. Supreme Court in the Cruzan case that same year. So that's done. So then the question arose, well, what do we do with people who don't happen to be on any life-sustaining treatment, who are not on a ventilator, who are not receiving dialysis or antibiotics, but who are still dying of a terminal illness, who are suffering just as terribly, but there's nothing, there's no handle, there's no tool to end their life earlier. And it was in this context that the assisted dying movement arose. It originally passed in Oregon in 1994. It passed narrowly. Then there was a lot of court opposition. It had to be put on the ballot again in 1997. This time it passed overwhelmingly and has, as I said, has been in effect in Oregon since 1998. And it was an attempt to deal with the situation of patients dying in agony without any life-sustaining treatment that could be stopped. Also, an advantage of the assisted dying method is it occurs at home. You know, if you talk to people and you say, how do you want to die? They say, we want to die at home with our loved ones around us. Everybody says that almost. And yet, it rarely happens. Most patients die a medicalized death in the hospital, often tethered by tubes. In Oregon, in the last almost 15 years, almost all of the patients who have used this law have died at home with the people around them that they wanted to have around them. So I think a great advantage is it demedicalizes death.
Is there something that clinicians who are interested in preparing themselves for this becoming more widely practiced, is there a book, an article that you could recommend that they read to get a good grounding in this?
An oncologist, I think he's an oncologist, named Sidney Wanzer, or Wanzer, W-A-N-Z-E-R, wrote a book a few years ago on this subject that I read and thought it was terrific. And I don't remember the name of the book, Joe. You'd have to look it up.
Yeah.
Oh, it's called To Die Well.
Okay, thanks.
By Sidney Wanzer, M.D.
All right, To Die Well. I want to thank you, Dr. Angel, for spending some time with us today, and I'd love to revisit the question if the act passes in a year or two, and see what what you've observed the change to be.
I fervently hope you have that opportunity. I really hope it passes. And Joe, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. That was our 158th edition. And all the earlier editions can be found at podcasts.jwatch.org. We come to you from Journal Watch, whose website is jwatch, that's J-W-A-T-C-H, .org. I'm Joe Elia. Thank you for listening.